Good morning. My name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. This morning's guest on With Respect is Rinker Buck. Rinker is the author of a fascinating new book called The Oregon Trail, which has just been released. It's a New York Times bestseller, and it has a subtitle of A New American Journey. With respect, Rinker Buck. Rinker, how are you this morning?
I'm well, and I'm glad to be here.
Good. I'm glad to have you as a guest here because I read this book, and I loved it. It's a great book. I mean, I don't want to compliment you too much because you might get a swelled head, but I thought it was a very interesting book. But let's start. The overall picture here is you started out from around St. Joe, Missouri, and you ended up in Oregon. Now, I know you. I'm not going to give a spoiler because so many things happen along the way, but it's not a spoiler to say that you survived because you're here talking with us. But the things that happened
survival
along
is
the way.
Big challenge.
the things that happen along the way are fascinating. So let me start off with what is the Oregon Trail? Where is it? How did you find it? And why did you do it?
Well, the Oregon Trail was the main pioneer route across the last stretch of the West that hadn't been settled yet. The peak migration of the pioneers was 1843 to the Civil War. But after the Civil War, and even today, it continues to live as a vital route for America and sort of a representation of American values, American fun. After the Civil War, it was the stagecoach route. We were very anxious to build the railroads. The railroads decided why resurvey a route that the pioneers had already found the best terrain. So the Union Pacific and Burlington Northern Line were laid down right along the trail. And it's now the busiest freight corridor in the world, mainly carrying products from the Northwest and coal from Wyoming. So this was the final route. About a million Americans crossed it in the 19th century, and this was the final route.
Wait a minute. Did you say a million Americans?
Yes. The number of pioneers in the 1840s and 1850s was, historians generally agree, between 350,000 and 400,000. After the Civil War, we entered what was called the Homesteader period. And at the same time, the stagecoaches were crossing. So there was another 300,000 or 400,000, probably as many as 600,000 that crossed the trail between, 1865 and 1880s. There were still pioneer wagon trains, homesteader wagon trains, right up until the 1890s. And so about a million Americans crossed. And when you consider what the population of the country was at that time, was a very significant percentage of the overall population.
Well, it's like taking a plug out of a bathtub of about 18, 20 million people, and one out of five or one out of 10 went over there.
Yes. Well, you got to remember there were two big migrations that contributed to this, actually three. Before the Civil War, you had the Mormons, 70,000 Mormons, who they were terribly persecuted where they were in the Midwest, so they decided to seek the protection of the Salt Lake Valley in Utah, and 70,000 of them crossed. And then the gold rush in 1849 contributed greatly to travel on the trail, and there was an extension of the Oregon Trail, which became the California Trail. And after Wyoming, the pioneers going to Oregon headed northwest, and the pioneers headed to the gold fields in California headed due west through Nevada and the Sierras and so forth. And about 25,000 Americans crossed in a single year during the 3 or 4 years of the gold rush. And then after that was the Colorado gold rush, and they also followed the Oregon Trail to the Colorado Gold Rush. So it was huge traffic, and a huge percentage of Americans actually took this thing. And one thing I say in the book is America was a very unstable place, and economically we were very unstable, and there was a bank panic every 10 years, and half the banks in the country would close and that sort of thing. Much worse, historians think, than even the Great Depression or the recession we suffered in 2008. And also, America was religiously a very contentious place. Churches were fighting over small doctrinal differences, and a lot of people escaped. This was one thing about the Oregon Trail I was fascinated by, because they don't tell you in the history books. But a lot of people were escaping uncomfortable hometowns back in the Midwest, even the East, where the religious squabbling had just become intolerable. So the trail played an important role, I see in the book, as being a release valve for the tensions in American society. I wonder what kind of society we would have had we never pushed beyond the Missouri River, the extra 2,000 miles to the Pacific coast. Economically, the country was periodically devastated, and religiously, the country was fighting all the time. So it kind of kept a contentious society. The existence of the trail kept a contentious society from imploding.
You know, there is a book by Frederick Jackson Turner written around, I think it was 1892 or something like that, which talked about the move westward was the salvation in another area, which is socially, that many of the he dealt with them as sort of the malcontents or the restless people. Had they been forced to stay in the central part, in the eastern part of the country, all hell would have broken loose. And I think that's what you're basically describing.
Yeah, I mean, Turner's frontier thesis was that understanding America means that you have to understand, at least for the 19th century, the perpetual existence of a new frontier. And I think in the 20th century, what became our new frontiers were these huge national efforts we had to wage to fight two world wars and then survive the Depression. So the lessons of the Oregon Trail, and a lot of which I go into in the book and provide kind of a revisionist history, but the lessons of the Oregon Trail are still things that are very much relevant to Americans today.
You know, this is a fascinating topic, because we are today going through so many stridencies that we're fighting from, you know, one party is fighting not only with the other party or parties, but also within the parties, individuals.
Immigration.
That's a huge issue. It was a huge issue back in the 1800s, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And look, this is a very important point, and it's a major reason why I wrote the book. We don't learn our real history. History is sanitized. It's heroified. We don't learn, for instance, who knows that Woodrow Wilson invaded Latin America three or four times during his presidency. He's only remembered for World War One, and so forth, or that Helen Keller became a socialist later on in life. We don't want our heroes to have a diversity and faults like that, so we don't teach that. But in fact, the history of the country was very chaotic. It was religiously very contentious. It was economically unstable, and immigrants were always treated terribly, and there was always a lot of xenophobia, fear of immigrants coming into this country. And when you go back and read the Oregon Trail history, this pioneer experience that is supposed to represent the ideal of American history, in fact, everybody hated the Catholics and the Mormons. There were separate Baptist and Methodist wagon trains, and they wouldn't camp in the same area at night because they were so hostile to each other, et cetera, et cetera. There was a lot of scamming of the pioneers by the merchants in the jumping-off towns along the Missouri River. They would use scare taxes to sell them way more barrels of bacon and flour and stuff than they really needed. And then when the pioneers hit the first hills in Kansas and Nebraska and their draft animals couldn't pull the loads, they would offload. They would throw jettison off a huge amount. One historian calls them the greatest litter bugs in history. Well, the merchants knew that, and they would hide their own wagons behind the bluffs, and as soon as the wagon train passed, they'd race down there, pick up all the bacon barrels and everything, take them back to St. Joe, and resell them to the next Pioneer train coming through. That's a portrait of America that's very different from the one that we get from the textbooks or from Hollywood. But it's very important that we confront that America and know what really happened. So all the contention, all the controversy and everything today, everyone fearing immigration and so forth, it's all there. It's all there in the history of the Oregon Trail.
You know, I want to quote back at you one of your paragraphs or a couple of lines from a paragraph along those same lines. And you say, history almost everywhere is tragic and ironic. But in America, the contrasts are more stark because we set such high ideals.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the fascinating thing, because we really do have these wonderful principles that, independence, freedom for all, right? You know, God created us, and we're all endowed by our Creator with the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Those are great, and they're unique, perhaps for the times that they were written. But you point further out in that paragraph just what you've just said now about on a mini level. With the people who were selling goods to the pioneers, you also talk about the big things that went wrong during the dark things that we did at the same time as we were propounding these wonderful ideals.
Sure. It all began, let me put it this way, it all began with the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, where we established some very, very high ideals and said we were the country that would be a beacon of hope and freedom for the world. And we continue to hold those ideals while living quite differently. Let me give you an example. Okay, in Russia, under the Tsars, under the Bolsheviks, and now under the crony capitalism of Vladimir Putin, there's no disingenuousness. There's no confusion about what Russia really stands for. And Vladimir Putin has said it recently himself. The Russian people like autocracy. They like strong central government, and they value that higher than, they're not democratically minded, and they value that higher than some of the freedoms that are enjoyed in the West. Well, Russia isn't being deceptive about that. They're not claiming high ideals and then doing something different. What they claim to do is, they annex Crimea or eastern Ukraine, whatever. Now they're bombing Syria. And it's pretty much in line with what they say. In Great Britain, up until World War II, the British were pretty clear that it was a society that existed for the aristocracy and the royalty, and that there was a different set of expectations and a different set of rights for the working class. But again, they weren't stating an ideal that was different from their behavior. I posit that we have always stated an ideal that it was different from our behavior. We practiced slavery. We didn't let women vote. I mean, just think about it. Until the 1920s, we didn't let women vote, et cetera, et cetera. So we are a country that states ideals but practices something different. We had to solve the slavery issue. 600,000 people had to die during the Civil War. On a per capita basis, it's still one of the bloodiest wars in history. So that's the anomaly, and a lot of it is written into the history, and you can read it in the history of the Oregon Trail, a lot of which I describe in the book.
I still posit something else, though. Agreeing with much of what you said, I still posit we need to survive as a country. We need some coherent reason. And I like to think that at least on the theoretical level, part of that reason is we believe in those things. We believe in equality. We believe in freedom. We believe in God-given rights and whatnot. Whether or not we live up to them is another issue. But if we didn't have the ideals, I'm not sure what we would be.
I think the ideals are important, and I agree with what you just said. And one thing that you can say is America has made such enormous progress and has been such an eventful place to experience. in our own lifetimes. Look at the civil rights struggle. The African Americans took back their freedom, and it was a very successful period. Look at women's rights. We finally went through a very successful period on that. There's a lot of business groups and so forth out there right now really, really talking about the fact that there are environmental regulations which make it more expensive to do business, et cetera. But look at the progress we've made on that issue. You can swim in some of these rivers again. Mm-hmm. You can swim in the Hudson River right beside Manhattan now.
Yep.
You couldn't do that.
That's right.
The Cuyahoga, 30 or 40 years ago.
The Cuyahoga
River. So having the ideals is great, and I think we've actually done a reasonably good job of living up to those ideals in our own time.
Yep.
But it's important to understand what the real history was.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, I want to take a break right now. We're talking to Rinker Buck, who is the author of a new book, The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. It's a New York Times bestseller right now. And Rinker is going to be here in St. Joseph at Forever Books on October 19th in the evening. And he'll have both a slideshow and talk about the things that he found and experienced, but also will be signing books for us. So, this is John Smetanka. We're on With Respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Rinker Buck, who is the author of The Oregon Trail, An American Journey. This is John Smetanka. So, Rinker, when we broke, we were talking about these ideals that hold us together or that allow us to make progress, and we can judge our effectiveness by what happens to meeting our goals, and we have done some. But let me back up here.
Mm-hmm.
The Oregon Trail. If I were to go out to St. Joe, Missouri, which I believe is about where it started,
mm-hmm.
and I was to walk out the door of the general store, I could get into some ruts, and I could follow those same ruts all the way out to California, out to Oregon. Is that correct?
That is correct. It's a 2,100-mile route that took the pioneers 4 months to cross, and when we crossed in a covered wagon, it took us the same amount of time. About half of the route is now two-lane blacktops because the trail went where people needed to go and still need to go, and such big cities and enterprises like Western Ranching and Omaha and Scotts Bluff and so forth were all along the trail. So the certain sections are paved, but there's plenty of places like Plum Creek or Ash Hollow, California Hill, where you can stop and see the sights of the trail. And then about the second half of the trail, particularly through Wyoming, there's one 350-mile stretch alone where you're on the original ruts the whole way. So the other half of the trail is the old dusty ruts that existed in the 19th century and that the pioneers followed. And yes, there are many, many places across the country where if you take a driving tour, you can see exactly what the old trail looked like for miles and miles and hundreds of miles.
Well, you know, I think that you mentioned in your book that a number of historians and people, ordinary people who are interested in the Oregon Trail made markers or researched where the trail had been by various interesting ways, and you can probably touch on a couple of those.
Sure. Well, first of all, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, there was this wonderful geezer named Ezra Meeker. He was kind of the John Muir of the Oregon Trail. And he started taking, after a very interesting career, after being a pioneer and becoming very successful in Washington State, actually, he started taking the trail backwards with a team of oxen and a wagon, his goal being, we need to preserve this trail and mark it. before it's all taken over by the gang plow or the irrigation project. And he was largely successful, and he got the process started. And he lived until about 1928. And he got the process started of marking the trail with granite markers. Preserving the trail was interrupted then by the Depression and by World War II. But in the early 1980s, a group of people, including historians, came along and started remarking the trail and preserving it. And the federal government got involved in naming the trail a National Historic Place and so forth. So the trail is this kind of marvelous combination today of the modern and the past. There are long, long stretches where you just ride along the Platte River on the same dusty ruts that the pioneers took. And then you can ride along Route 80 and see other sections of it. So there's been quite an effort to preserve it by a wonderful group, an underfunded group called the Oregon and California Trails Association. And yes, you can still see, it's all still there. That's one of the big themes of the book. It's all still there. You can see it.
You know, there I read a Reader's Digest, I think, article back in, way back in time, about an airlines pilot who was flying out to Arizona, New Mexico from Chicago, I guess it was. And as he was flying along, he started to look down below, and lo and behold, he saw a trail of some sort or a marking of some sort. And so he thought, this is strange. So he apparently went down. When he finished, he got into his car and drove back and saw that there were two ruts or a series of ruts going from the Midwest, I guess St. Louis, or maybe St. Joe, Missouri, I'm not sure, but all the way down to Albuquerque and Santa Fe. And this was the Santa Fe Trail, which up till that time had not been fully recognized as still existing. But you know, you said something about the ruts, but there weren't just one set of ruts going out there, were there?
No, and I explained that in the book. Probably one of the greatest misnomers in American history was to call it the Oregon Trail. In fact, the first 1,000 miles, which stretched from St. Joe or Weston or Independence, Missouri, along the Missouri River, which was the frontier then, the first 1,000 miles to Fort Bridger, Wyoming, is, in fact, shared by the California Trail and the Mormon Trail. So, and thousands of immigrants crossed to get to the Gold Rush and of course, to get to the promised land of Salt Lake. But along that stretch, there's about 40 different cutoffs, alternate routes, et cetera. For instance, in Wyoming, you have the Lander Road, the Sublette Cutoff, the Salt Creek Cutoff, et cetera, the Hams Fork Cutoff. We took a combination of them, and as a matter of fact, in some places where the rivers were overflowed, just like what happened to the pioneers and we couldn't cross, we would take one of these cutoffs to get to South Pass or wherever we were going. So really, the Western Trail System and the Oregon Trail itself was, as I say in the book, a collection of trails. It was a broad avenue across the plains, usually following the great river valleys, the Platte, the Sweetwater, the Bear, the Snake, because the pioneers, of course, needed that water, and it was an easy navigational guide. But it was a collection of trails. It wasn't a single trail. And most of those trails grew out of the original Indian traces that the tribes used. And after the Lewis and Clark expedition in 18, before the Indians provided guidance to the fur trappers, which was a great economic era in American history, to get to the Rockies and trap beaver. And the trail just grew organically out of all those things.
Well, let me ask you this. You've identified several different reasons that people would go out in this heroic, I say heroic in the sense that it's just huge effort. But you got us to the point where the Mormon Trail stops and the California Trail goes off to the side, but why would people go out to Oregon, for pity's sakes?
Well, at the time, America was in a very expansionist mode, and the British to the Hudson's Bay Company, that was their trapping empire, their fur empire, the British had about 500 employees of the Hudson's Bay Company in the Pacific Northwest, in what is now Oregon and Washington State. And the Polk administration realized that, first of all, we were going to fight a war with Mexico and take over Texas and Southern California and Arizona and New Mexico. But we could complete the continental ownership of the entire United States from the Atlantic to the Pacific if we also got the Northwest Territories. And just to give you an example of what happened, there were 500 British there in 1843 when the American migration began, and it was encouraged by the government. By 1845, there were 5,000 Americans. So it was all over at that point. The British quickly negotiated a treaty which ceded all those lands to us. So that was one motive. But a second motive was, as I said, the country was economically very unstable, and people were literally dispossessed of their farms and their homes and had to go somewhere. They were homeless, and they were people who'd been uprooted by economic mayhem. And so they needed a place, and there was free land in Oregon. There was a great amount of missionary zeal at the time, growing out of the Second Great Awakening, which was a religious revival that started in the 1820s. People wanted to go out and convert the Indians. That was a huge motive at the time, sort of white man's burden, American version of white man's burden. And there was also, as I mentioned, small town America was not a pleasant place to live because the religious battles were so severe. And that was one of the, and so people migrated for that reason. And that was one of the discoveries I made while researching this book, and something so much fun to write about, because we think of our own age as being religiously contentious over issues like abortion and gay marriage. And in fact, American society has always been, the irony being, we're a society based, one of the first societies based on religious tolerance. And as soon as you give people the right to be religiously tolerant, they turn around and have the freedom to carp about somebody else's religion. So again, it just goes back to the point I made, which is discover the real history of your country, not this sanitized version that you find in the textbooks.
You know, we talk about heroes and the pioneer. As you explained the derivation of the word pioneer, but there are some people who stood out, whose names and their actions stood out. Now, one of the people that you talked about was a woman, Narcissa Whitman, who it's phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal, powerful person. What about her?
Right. Well, she's fascinating because one of the mistaught themes of the 19th century is that women were submissive and they were just housewives and this and that. Of course, it wasn't true. And if you look at all the social reform movement that grew out of the Great Awakening, abolitionism, abstemiousness with liquor and so forth, suffragette movement, they were all led by women. But Narcissa Whitman was a product of that time, typical of this. And she decided that she wanted to become a missionary and save a tribe called the Cayuse in eastern Washington state. And at the time, this was in the late 1830s, 1836, at the time there was enormous prejudice against women actually entering what was called the Great American Desert or Indian Country. Those were the actual terms for the territories out there, which were not yet a part of the United States. And it was felt that women couldn't take the rigors of the trip. No one had proven yet that a covered wagon for 2,000 miles only would take them, say, between western Pennsylvania and Indiana or something along an established freight road. The women would be subject to the leering Indian braves and so forth. They couldn't take the travel. And there were some very, very prominent Americans, including Horst Greeley, the newspaper editor in New York, and George Catlin, who was a famous a painter of Indians, who argued against it. You can't let white women go west. Well, in 1836, Narcissa Whitman and her husband, Marcus Whitman, decided that they would go out to Washington State and start a mission for the Indians. And they were the first covered wagon travelers, and it was Narcissa Whitman's Letters Home, which in those days, Letters Home were often published in the local newspapers. It was her Letters Home where she described how happy and healthy she was on the trail, how one of the quotes was, I dare say I have never traveled on a better highway than the great American desert, et cetera, et cetera. It was her Letters Home that convinced Americans that it was safe for women and children to go. And in fact, Narcissa Whitman conceived on the trail and had a healthy baby once she got out to the Pacific Northwest, which, again, all Americans knew from her Letters Home. And so she was more critical in terms of putting people on the trail than, say, mountain men like Jim Bridger and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
She really pioneered the trail, and in fact, her husband came back and led, Marcus Whitman led, what was called the Great Migration in 1843, which was the first sizable wagon train to cross. About 1,000 people crossed in one wagon train that year that was jointly led by Marcus Whitman.
We're going to take a break right now because, and I'm going to cut you off on talking about Narcissa and Marcus Whitman because people can read about the last part of the story, which is equally fascinating about those two particular people and their families. But we're on With Respect with Rinker Buck, who is the author of The Oregon Trail, a new American journey. And Rinker will be here in St. Joseph, and he will be signing books and giving a presentation with slides and explanation at Forever Books in downtown St. Joe on the 19th of October, Monday. This is John Smetanka, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Rinker Buck, the author of The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. And as I said, that he will be presenting a summary of this of his book and showing pictures and whatnot and also signing books at Forever Books in downtown St. Joseph on the 19th of October, next Monday. So, Rinker, you took this trip, and how long it is? How many miles?
It's 2,100 miles.
Now you took it in an Oldsmobile 98. Is that what it was?
Yeah, it was a 1888 Peter Shuttler covered wagon.
One of the fascinating things. One of the things about your book I love is that it's interesting on many levels, and I remember as everybody who went through school, like in high school, I guess, in English class, you had to read Moby Dick. And Moby Dick is a great book. It's hugely long. And it's hugely long because the middle 200 pages are about the history, the biology, and everything else of the whale. And
right.
And most human beings, and I know, don't have enough tolerance to go through and read all of what Herman Melville told about the whales. But in your book, you talk about the Shuttler wagon, you talk about mules, and you talk about a number of other aspects which make a critical difference in the travel on the Oregon Trail. But let's take for a minute the Shuttler wagon. What is that?
Well, the Peter Shuttler wagon, it's a brand name that's forgotten now, although people recognize other brand names like International Harvester, Sears and Roebuck, John Deere, Studebaker. They all started as covered wagon companies, too. But Peter Shuttler was actually, he was a German immigrant in Chicago. He was actually the largest wagon manufacturer of the 19th century. At least 30,000 of his wagons crossed the plains with the pioneers. And he was one of the first to set up an assembly line manufacturing type enterprise for the wagon with interchangeable parts so that if your wagon broke, you could telegraph back or have sent by mail or whatever, a part that would fit exactly. Prior to that, most wagons were handmade in little cottage industry type places.
That sounds like the Ford assembly line.
Yeah, and I say in the book that Henry Ford was not the first American to pioneer the assembly line. Actually, the assembly line was developed for meeting the enormous demand of the covered wagon era. The Peter Shuttler Works was the largest factory in Chicago. It was a 10-acre complex. Peter Shuttler built the biggest mansion in Chicago, competing with the Marshall Field department store Barron's. And what I try to do with the organ, with the book, is show how the history of the covered wagon is really the history of America itself. If you understand how the covered wagon matured and became accessible to almost any American family, just like the automobile did in the 20th century, how interchangeable parts and things like that were introduced. We conquered Britain as a steel manufacturer, largely because we had to perfect all the techniques for making the right steel parts, iron and steel parts, for the covered wagon. If you understand the history of the covered wagon, you understand the history of America itself.
But also, another one that I was fascinated with is the history of the mule.
The
mule. Good grief.
Yeah. Well, the mule. I mean, without the mule, you don't have America, okay? So the first thing is about it that I wrote about is George Washington was the original Maharaja of mules. after the American Revolution, prior to the American Revolution, you couldn't find a mule in America or a big draft mule. There were some out of Mexico, but they weren't big draft mules that were needed to pull these heavy wagons. And the reason for that was that America was an entity, an extension of the British Empire. And the French and the Spanish, who had spent all of the 18th century fighting one war after another against the British, were not going to export what were called mammoth jacks, which is the burro side of the mule. They were not going to export those donkeys to America and allow breeding of mules because they were competing with Great Britain. But as soon as the Revolution was over, and now Washington is a global hero, and the French and the Spanish couldn't be more excited that the British are out of North America as rulers. Literally, within a year or two, they sent the King of Spain and Lafayette from France, sent a whole boatload of mammoth jacks and jennies to the female burro to breed. And Washington actually was the first mule breeder in America. And by the time of his death, he had 60 working mules at Mount Vernon alone, his plantation in Virginia. He was sending mammoth jacks all over America at a fee to breed with female horses so they could create mules. And then you just followed all the way through. In the Civil War, the mules, there were 1 million mules pulling the wagons. And if you see a Hollywood movie of the Civil War, of course, they use horses, which is inaccurate. World War I, 2 million mules, 2 million American mules over in Europe. World War II, there were still 30,000 mules along such places as the Burma Road or the Alps in Italy, because you couldn't get a Jeep, you couldn't get some kind of pulling vehicle with a combustion engine over some of this terrain, but mules still did it. We still have mules. We have 2 locations for military mules in America today because they've been used in Afghanistan and Iraq and so forth. So, again, understand the history of the mule and what the advantages of the mule were, and you understand the history of America.
Now, on this Shuttler wagon, and that's different. You can talk in the book about the difference between it and the Conestoga wagon, which is what sometimes we, from movies, we think was the way to go. But that's in the book. But you had 3 mules. And
yes.
And they had personalities. And they were your buddies or they were your enemies. And tell us about these 3 guys.
Sure. Well, the first thing you have to understand about mules is they have a reputation for being stubborn, but that's only because the people driving those mules often don't know what they're doing. One of the big advantages of the hybrid creation of a mammoth Jack Burrow and a female horse is that you get the larger cranial capacity, the larger brain of the feral Burrow. And so while a horse is domesticated for centuries and inclined to just do what you ask him to do most of the time, like a well-bred dog, the burrow side of the mule gives it a self-preservation instinct, a feral instinct, and a larger brain. And so the mule will say, well, wait a minute here, I'm not going to cross this river until you prove to me it's safe. And so that advantage translates out into the mules have these very, very distinct personalities and a lot different than the horses. So like Butte, she was one of our Molly or female mules. And Butte, she knew that she has a cute little rump and a smaller head than the other ones. And she kind of had Morgan horse good looks. And she knows she's good looking. And she would sort of say in the morning, give me a look of, oh, you're putting that harness on me? You want me to pull this wagon?
Moi?
And we started calling her Kate Hudson, because Butte just wanted to sit on the chaise lounge all day in a bikini and look pretty and not do any work. And then we had Beck, and we called her Anne, after Anne Hathaway, the part that Anne Hathaway had in Rachel Got Married. Because she was a crazy girl. She was a beautiful, she is a beautiful, athletic, tall, jet black mule. And she's always pulling hard in harness and everything. But she could walk by 10 mailboxes and the door's shut and she's fine. You walk by 11th mailbox and the door's open and she jumps out of harness, tries to leap over the pole, pulls the mules all the way over into the road, into traffic, and so forth. And you could never predict when Beck was going to be crazy. And Beck in particular despised me. She liked my brother a lot more. And she would just give me this look in the morning, you know, like, if you try and put that harness on me, bud, I'm going to kick your brains out. And she meant it. But she would tolerate my brother. And then, so the crazy Beck. And then we had Jake, who was a John mule, a gelded male mule. And Jake was this gentle giant. He was almost 18 hands tall, imperturbable, very sweet-natured, and in the morning, every morning, he would come over in the corral and put his muzzle in between my arm and my body and just want to get hugs and me scratch his ears and everything. And he was a very hard worker and very imperturbable. And so when we get into difficult situations where the other mules were shying at traffic or a train going by or something like that, then Jake would reach over and kind of nip them a little and say, cut it out, girls, you know. Let's get the job done first. And he would protect them in the corral. If a dog came in or something, mules don't like dogs too much, he would chase the dog away and take care of his mollies kind of thing. So we had three mules, three very distinctive personalities, three challenges every day, or two challenges, and then Jake every day driving across the plains. But we got there, and they settled down a lot. As the trip progressed, they settled down.
Well, there's one more four-legged companion you had that I want to talk about. And then after our break, I want to talk about your brother, who you just mentioned, and your family. But
sure.
you had a four-legged, I don't know what you'd call her role, but tell us about Olive Oil.
Well, Olive Oil is the ultimate trail dog. You know, if this thing gets made into a movie, I can't wait to help cast her. She is a white Jack Russell Terrier, rough coat with a brown, you know, the perfect brown patch over her eye and everything. And she was my brother's dog, and he wanted to bring her along, and he kind of treats her like another member of the family. And, well, if we bring Olive Oil along, you know, she'll never forget the trip, you know, kind of thing. And it turned out that she was really a great asset for the trip because for about 700 miles where the trail disappeared or wasn't marked terribly well or had been eroded out by a rainstorm or something, I would have to scout ahead of the wagon on foot, and I would walk half the day, climb up to the highest point, look down and see the Platte River or the Sweetwater River, and then get our navigation point, and then walk down and direct my brother through. And all of that area was rattlesnake country. It was also prairie dog country, and it's kind of like elephants and mice, you know. The mules just didn't like prairie dogs, and the rattlesnakes could be dangerous if you stepped on one of them inadvertently. But Olive Oil would jump out of the wagon and run circles around me. She'd run this patrol. She'd run circles ahead of us. And if you know anything about Jack Russells, nothing lives.
I do. One of our neighbors
says. In their zone. So Olive Oil would run ahead of us and protect me from rattlesnakes and stuff like that. And she did several other things. The coyotes wouldn't come into our camp because they just hear Olive Oil. And, you know, the coyotes would probably rip her to pieces. But I had another Jack Russell Terrier many years earlier, and we had coyotes in the rural area of New England where I live. And Jack Russell doesn't care. Our Jack Russell would come home all bitten up and torn and bleeding and everything. She'd take on as many coyotes as were there. But one thing is they never came near the house. So the coyotes never came near our camp either. So we had this very, very lovable dog who was a major character in the book.
Good. Now, I'm going to take a break right now, and then we're going to be talking about your very unique family and your brother. This is John Smetanka. Our program is With Respect, and we're on with this week's guest is Rinker Buck, who is the author of The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. And Rinker will be in the St. Joseph area on October 19th, when he will be signing books and giving a lecture on his ventures. We'll be right back. This is With Respect. We're now back on With Respect with Rinker Buck, the author of The Oregon Trail, An American Journey. And as I mentioned before, Rinker will be in St. Joseph at Forever Books at 7 o'clock p.m. On October 19th, which is a Monday evening. And he will be talking about his adventures and also signing some books. This is John Smetanka. Now, Rinker, I talked about all your companions, but I want to talk about a nuance of this book that is different, I think, than most people would expect out of an adventure. People take a journey and have adventures along the way, and that is that your family, both internally inside of you and also your brother, had a big role to play in getting this going and keeping you going, and you learned a lot. Tell me, first of all, about your dad and mom.
Sure. I was very fortunate that I grew up under parents, Tom Buck and Pat Buck, who were what I would call grounded dreamers. They thought that, ideals and adventure and dreams were just as important as, say, a practical education of children. And so we were always going off and doing these interesting things. We took a covered wagon ourselves. We had a horse farm, so we took a covered wagon in the late 50s just from our farm in northern New Jersey down to Pennsylvania. My brother and I rebuilt an airplane when we were still our teenagers and flew it to California and back. Didn't even realize until we got there that we were the youngest, or called the youngest ever to do it, and so forth. So there was always some new frontier for us, some new interesting thing to do. And that influenced me quite a bit. And what happened when I got out along the trail, I didn't expect this to happen, but all of these memories of my dad started flashing backwards. Something would happen along the trail, like we had a huge amount of trouble one day crossing a big Blue River near Marysville, Kansas. And I remembered similar trouble on our covered wagon trip in 1958 when our horses could see through the metal grating in a bridge and see the water down below in the Delaware River, and they refused to cross. So my dad, even though he had a wooden leg, he lost his leg in a plane crash in the late 40s. He pulled the wagon across with all the kids sitting there on the front seat, you know, sucking their thumb. And there's a picture of that in the book. So what happened, which was unexpected, was at significant junctures in the trip, I just would have these incredibly strong flashbacks to my father. Some of it, all the good stuff about him, some of it, the painful stuff when he got older and so forth. And I just made that a part of the book. First of all, I thought it was important to explain to readers what was my motivation, or why did I feel that I could take a trip like this. It's not many people wake up in the morning and say, I think I'll just buy a team of mules from the Amish, get an old wagon, and cross the Oregon Trail. You know, well, there was a reason that I felt empowered to do that. And so I started writing about it for that reason, but because of all the flashbacks and everything on the trip, I went into it deeper. So my book is a story about crossing the trail and its history and what the Oregon Trail is today. But it's also a story of American family and one's psychological journey through time based on memories of upbringing.
What about... Now, you were your father was a publisher of a magazine, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. His title was actually associate publisher, because the owner of Look magazine in those days was a fellow named Mike Coles, and Mike kept the title of publisher for himself. But my dad ran the magazine, and it was a very interesting upbringing we had, because, you know, somebody from the magazine or one of the subjects of the magazine or big politicians or whatever. We're always over at the house. And in addition to being publisher of Look, my dad was very active in politics. He was one of the campaign managers for Jack Kennedy's race in 1960 and so forth. And so there was always something unusual happening around our house, or people that I was meeting through my dad. So he was quite a character. He was a classic larger-than-life person, and, you know, you're very fortunate as a writer to have a parent like that, because it's like the well seems never to be empty.
Yeah, and you're a member of a large family. I think it was 11 children in the family, and one of them was your brother Nick, and he was the one that came with you, and I don't think you planned on that.
No, I didn't plan on it. Just to show you what a chucklehead I am, I mean, the first line of the book is, I appreciate that naivete is the mother of all adventure. So I thought I was gonna go alone, you know, and I was going to drive these mules, and I'd have a riding horse and all this stuff. And so because I was going to have a riding horse, which once my brother Nick decided to come along, he vetoed. But because I was going to have a riding horse, I needed my old saddle. And that saddle was up in my brother's barn in Maine, just gathering dust. So I sent him an email, and I said, hey, I'm going to take this Oregon Trail trip. He's a great horseman, too, very, very skilled at driving team, and a brilliant mechanic, but very different from me. And I sent him an email, and I said, hey, I need that saddle because I'm going to Oregon on a covered wagon. And Nick happened to have a lot of time on his hands then, because he'd been injured in a construction accident, and his foot was shattered, and he was just about recovered and walking again, but he couldn't really work for another several months. So he emails me back. His emails are charming things and grammatical, like Civil War soldiers or something that you can read in their diaries. And he wrote me back and said, I'll send you the saddle. Just tell me where and when. Why didn't you tell me, you asshole, that you're taking the Oregon Trail this year? I'm coming. And so Nick came along, and we're very different. He's very blue-collar and has a tendency to use language that we're not going to talk, say, here, and
thank,
so forth.
Thank you very much.
But he made a huge difference for the trip, because he could drive a team through all these sagebrush obstacles and across rivers and stuff that we had to do. And whenever we broke something, he could fix it out of a stick we found beside the trail. So he was, it was a study in contrasts of personalities, actually giving you the full personality that you needed to make the trip.
You know, you have two brothers who had, you had not lived near each other for a long time, I take it. And, he, all of a sudden, he is now your traveling companion. You're different people. Yeah, great. It's a good thing that there's a balance between the two of you. However, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get along all the time. And part of the charm of this book is to see the interplay between the two of you.
Yeah. Nick was the kind of guy who you'd say something and he goes, "You know, I feel sorry for a talented guy like you who's so stupid." You know, that was his way of addressing reality. And what I learned on the trip, probably the single most valuable lesson, was to sublimate my own personality. You know, don't be a control freak. Don't try and always win. And, you know, with a guy like Nick, you're never going to win in the sarcasm game. So just give up. And so instead of telling him what the agenda for the day was or demanding things of him, I just let the day happen and was much more silent than I normally was. And it worked out to be brilliant for the trip, and it also worked out to be, you know, an extraordinary lesson for me.
You know, it's a fascinating read because you capture in dialogue and you capture in description of background your father, your family, and especially your brother in ways that are really, they're gripping. If you're interested in psychology and how families deal with one another and grow, this is a book for you. Because it's reality. It's good. Families don't necessarily all, certainly are not the same. Is not cookie cutter kids coming out of the same family. They're all different. We all find that out with our different children. But you captured it, and I thought that was very good. And the last thing I want to talk, and unfortunately we're running out of time, but that gives you a chance. To talk more about this on Monday the 19th at 7 o'clock at the Forever Books in St. Joe, downtown St. Joe. What did you take out of this trip? When you did it, 2,200 miles, we know you've survived. What lasting effect did it have on you, and what message do you want to give?
I think dreaminess is more important than practicality, and you shouldn't overplan something. We just decided to go, and we put together the wagon and the mules pretty quickly and just went and made it up as we went along. And because there was so much about it that was uncertain, and I talk about that living with uncertainty, we were comfortable just making it up as we go along. If you overplan something and have a sort of pre-formulated outcome, you're going to be disappointed because, oh, well, you know, I didn't know the wheels were going to break, you know.
All right. Well, this has been a delight talking to you, Rinker, and I look forward to seeing you at Forever Books on the 19th at 7 o'clock. And I hope that everybody who's listening to this will dream and say their dreams are not stupid, because if the dreams are what makes life fun, and the guts to carry out the dreams is what makes us good characters or interesting characters. The name of our program is With Respect. My name is John Smetanka, and we have had Rinker Buck here. Rinker, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, John. I've enjoyed it a lot.
Great. Remember, ladies and gentlemen of the audience, our mantra, if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.